Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today's podcast is about military 3D printing. The interest in additive manufacturing has grown as the technology edges into the fleet and into the industrial processes of major suppliers, such as engine fuel nozzles from General Electric or generator turbine blades from Siemens. 3D printing was also a topic of discussion during the April Sea, Air, and Space Conference from the Navy League, with flag officers from both the Navy and Coast Guard discussing its future in the fleet. To that end, we interviewed James Lambeth, additive manufacturing lead at the Navy's Damnnik facility in Virginia. We discussed the kinds of additive technologies his facility is using and how the concept is moving forward into the fleet. However, 3D printing was first embraced by the Army and has seen service in Afghanistan. So, we interviewed James Zanino of the Picatinny Arsenal in New Jersey to discuss the new technologies being developed there. Except that audio file got eaten by the computer. Don't worry, I'll give you the broad strokes, and we'll get him back. We'll discuss these topics and more after the short break.
Do you enjoy Sea Control? Sure you do. You're one of the good ones. We are available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. We invite you to subscribe, leave a comment and a rating. We value your input. Tell all of your friends about us. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise thinks Grape Nuts is actually a good cereal. Seriously.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. So it's been in the news, and a lot of folks in the SimSec world and, well, anywhere excited about it, additive manufacturing, 3D printing. In civilian world, we've already seen many applications from the development of turbine blades for aircraft to the use for human skulls. In the military, we are trying to embrace this technology as well. And today on Sea Control, I am joined by James Lambeth, additive manufacturing lead at CDSA Damnnik. How are you doing, Jim?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Not too bad. I'm really pleased you could join us today. And before we start, you're kind of in a niche market. You're the additive manufacturing lead. Maybe give the audience a little insight who you are, where you're from, and how it is you came into a position like this.
Yes, I'm from Virginia Beach. It's where I currently work at CDSA Damnnik. My background, I have a mechanical engineering degree and engineering management degree from Virginia Tech and ODU respectively. And prior to here, I worked for Huntington Ingalls in the shipyard. And being from the area, I have a large Navy background, a lot of Navy internships. So I embrace the naval community and I work well with them. As for additive manufacturing, we're just in a great location. I enjoy learning about these new technologies. And so I've kind of just done my own research. And when we were looking for a lead, we were kind of in a pristine location. And we had the background and our command has a lot of experience with 3D printing. So that's how I got involved with 3D printing at Damnnik.
So you went from Huntington Ingalls, so the industrial juggernaut, to the small, nimble 3D printing project at
yes.
Damnnik. That's awesome. And you said, actually, before we get into our main topic, you'd said your command had a lot of experience with 3D printing. Before NWDC started this project on 3D printing and they started the attempt to get it out to the fleet, what is it that the experience with 3D printing was before that?
Well, it was similar to probably a lot of other organizations prior to now, was rapid prototyping. So we could traditionally, if you wanted to develop a part, part of the R&D process was to send it out for fabrication and bring it back and test it. And that cost was extremely high and the lead time was extremely high. And so what we did instead was we would 3D print a part, we could test fit it, test the part. And if we didn't like it, we could iterate in 24 hours in lieu of 3 months. And so that's how we got involved in that process. And we've been doing that for years.
So that's a good historical scope to look at. We have this new idea, this is how we're going to use 3D printing. But a lot of folks kind of forget this technology in many places was still being utilized. Maybe not in the rapid fleet-wide way that some of us envision, but, it's out there. So it's a question of utilization rather than really access. Now, describe the machine you're working. People hear the word additive manufacturing. You know, that's a key word for us. We know what that means. But for everyone else who's listening, what does it mean when you say additive manufacturing? Describe how the machine works, maybe some of the different types of processes you guys have been considering, and how it is that an object is made through this additive manufacturing process.
There is a wide range of technologies. Additive manufacturing just means we're adding material instead of subtracting material, like most traditional manufacturing processes. Specifically, ours is our printer is called, most commonly called FDM, which is a fused deposition modeling, or material extrusion would be the proper name. And so what it does is it there are spools of a thermoplastic that the nozzle melts, and the nozzle deposits onto a build plate, and it will build a cross section in the X and Y, say, direction left and right. And then the build plate would drop a very small amount, and it would build another cross section on top of that. And that's how our Stratasys machine works right now. And we're building in, we're building with polycarbonate and ABS plastic-like material. The other types out there, previously we had something called polyjet technology or material jetting. And what that did was it deposited a liquid resin onto a build platform and cured it with a UV light. There is stereolithography we've also looked at. That's also uses UV light to cure a vat of liquid resin. And probably one of the other big ones, and this is something we're looking at, I think this is a little bit farther in the future, at least for us, but a lot of other organizations have it, and that's a powder bed. What that is the manufacturing process is there's a bed of powder, any type of powder. Generally, this is used for metallic printing. So generally, you'd have a bed of metallic powder, and then you use some type of high energy source, usually some type of some laser or electron beam to fuse the material together. And you would add a new layer of metallic powder on top of the old layer, fuse the next cross section, and slowly the build plate would move down, and you're fusing material on top of each other. And it's an amazing technology, you know, building metal parts from scratch. It's an expensive technology, but it can do a lot for you.
What sort of got us to the podcast today, we had a conversation with the XO of Whidbey Island, one of the ships out there in Norfolk, and we solved a real-life problem in the past month. So a ship, it's got a problem with some junction boxes. The junction boxes are old. They need to be replaced, but the problem is in between the point where they needed to be replaced and the point where we have what we have now is someone changed the kind of junction box. So none of the mounts work anymore. So now you have the possibility where the ship has to go out and do metal work, start cutting into the hull and replacing all of these mounts for the junction boxes. That costs a lot of time, that costs a lot of money, there's a lot of structure work, and there's a lot of mistakes that can be made that require a rework, so it's a whole mess. We directed Lieutenant Commander Toth, the XO, towards you, Jim, over there at Damneck, and maybe you could describe kind of what you did for the Whidbey Island.
Yes. This is still a work in progress, but what we've done is we've printed adapter plates. And so there are the tricky part about this is that there are several variations. There's not one adapter plate for every junction box all over the ship. There's four or five variations depending on the size of the old box and the size of the new box. And so we may be only producing somewhere between 5 and 10 types of each variation. So creating a bracket has the potential to be cost prohibitive if we're using, say, traditional manufacturing. Obviously, if we're producing in bulk and buying 10,000 of these, then traditional manufacturing may be the better course of action. But because we're doing a small quantity, we're 3D printing each variation. And then we can also make modifications if there's something they'd like to change about this. And so where we are now is we've test printed in a cheaper material, ABS plastic, just to see if it fits. And it does. And so we can mount, we've mounted the junction boxes in certain locations to test fit. And so now we're looking at, and this is probably the most difficult part of the job thus far, is a qualification of parts. And we're looking at how we can qualify these brackets so they meet all the specifications for shipboard use and to mount these junction boxes. And there's quite a few technical warrant holders that we have to go through. And we're looking at different types of material options. We're actually looking at upgrading our machine so we can print in another thermoplastic called Ultem. It's a lot more heat resistant, a lot stronger. And so we're seeing what we can do to meet all the specifications and produce these parts. And then we're also running, and we haven't finished our cost analysis to determine that the plastic is cheaper. So we're going to compare the plastic parts, the full cost of the plastic parts, to full cost of, say, traditionally manufactured aluminum brackets.
This is a good educational opportunity. Describe in a slightly more detailed way the process that a part would need to go through in order to get, say, certified. So if someone came by and slapped the table, sorry, that's a slang term that I keep hearing at work. Slap the table means kind of accept the idea. So if someone was to finally accept this idea and say, go ahead, these are solid, what are the steps it would have to, who would it have to go through?
That's the tricky part, is that depending on the part, every part would have to go through a different set of people, different set of technical warrant holders. So for this part, we have some material science experts over at Naval Surface Warfare Center, Cardrock. And it was noted that there's a non-metallic materials expert, a shock expert, vibration expert, a survivability expert, electrical systems expert, EMI expert. All these groups survive. All these groups we need to go through and get their blessing on effectively. And there's different mill standards for meeting say survivability or vibration and shock standards. So we need to, generally speaking, provide proof that the part is as strong or stronger than the old design, or test it to prove that it would survive all these shock and vibration events and such.
Yeah, because you mentioned as strong as the older part. In this particular case, you're building something that doesn't exist in the stock system. For those who are wondering, stock system is the Navy's official supply system, so it's the giant catalog from which you would pull anything. But what are you learning through this process about? So you've got a part that doesn't exist anywhere. You're just trying to build something new. What is it that you're noticing is different about this, or especially challenging about it?
The challenging thing is one of the many advantages of additive manufacturing is the ability to produce unique parts quickly. And so if we need to go through a 3-year qualification process, it really cuts back on what additive manufacturing technology can do. And so that's why we're looking at, right now we're reviewing, let's just say, easy parts, parts that require minimal qualification tests, and kind of getting those out in the ship, and then looking at more difficult ones. And some of them we don't know what's going to be difficult. I didn't at the beginning, we didn't expect it to be this difficult, but that's good. We're learning from this, and we can document this and use this as a means to improve our methodology in the future.
Absolutely, and hopefully it's on both sides of the tracks as well, on the inspection and certification side, as this technology is used more and we do more experiments, as they learn too. So you're hitting on to the really fun topic we should hit. So we've done all the educational stuff. Now we talk about the fun things. What could you see yourself doing? So you've worked at Huntington Ingalls. You work at Damneck now. You've been around a lot of ships. You've been around the Navy community. Now you have this piece of technology in front of you. What is it that you can do with it? Or what do you imagine us being able to do with it? Or what has it that you would want to do that you necessarily haven't had the opportunity for?
Okay. I think there is a kind of a short-term goal and a long-term goal. The immediate goal, which is what we're beginning right now, is we're developing partnerships throughout the Navy and looking for, let's say, requests for parts. And we're actually doing this right now. So anybody listening, I would encourage them, anybody with an idea, to come to me and let me know what type of parts maybe we could print for you and manufacture and send out to your ship. And so what we're trying to do is right now is 3D print parts at our location in Virginia Beach and send them out where necessary. And because we're in the Virginia Beach, Norfolk area right now, there's a large Navy community. I can drive and distribute parts if need be. Beyond that, we're developing a network of other, say, warfare centers and naval facilities that have 3D printers, printing technology. So that way we can 3D print parts at different locations. If we want a part on the West Coast instead of shipping something from Virginia Beach, well, we'll just get our friends out in Keyport or Port Hueneme to print those parts and send them to the nearby installation. And so I think in the near future, we're going to see more and more naval installations with these 3D printers. And if someone were to request a part, they can just either have it shipped from the closest naval installation or walk off the ship and just grab the part from the printer. And long term, we're going to be trying to put these printers shipboard. We've actually recently ran a couple experiments with a plastic-like printer out in San Diego on Essex.
The USS Essex. Yep.
That's right. And just as a test bed for that. But eventually, what's going to happen is we're going to have after putting printers on naval installation, then we'll start putting more printers shipboard. Maybe we'll start with the large ships with the carriers and work our way down to the smaller ships. And so we'll be printing, and then with that said, we'll also be the technology will be improving. And so we'll start with probably plastic printers, which definitely have their advantages, but there's also other limitations. So eventually, what we'll be doing is switching from say the plastic printers to maybe some different polymer printers to eventually metallic printers, which have a whole set of challenges associated with those. And we're working through that and how to print shipboard with those. But I do foresee in the long-term future having printers that can print in a variety of materials, including metal, across a variety, if not most, naval ships.
Yeah, that would be incredible. And two, you mentioned the challenges, technical challenges on board is, imagine a powder printer. That'd be a difficult thing to do on a small ship, and I imagine rather challenging on a large ship, because if the ship takes a roll and you've had something being printed for 6 or 7 hours, and all of a sudden that powder bed shifts, well, it was fun, but let's start again. So talk about the other facilities that you're engaged with. Have any of your coalition of 3D printers, have you been thinking of any other major projects? So you're calling out for parts. You're looking for folks who are interested. You're working on the USS Essex. Is there anything other, any other ideas that are in the immediate future that you see the 3D printers being able to accomplish?
Well, right now we also received a request from NAVAIR, looking maybe at creating some educational materials for them, helping print some parts, some models that just aren't available anywhere. And if they wanted to begin production of those parts, it'd be quite expensive. And well, we can just model and print those for dirt cheap in comparison. Beyond that, yeah, we have a large network, a large group within the warfare centers we're looking at. I think the projects are geared towards how do we bring this technology forward. So we have, for example, I mentioned Card Rock. They have a lot of the material science experts, and so we're working with them in terms of determining how to qualify parts. We also have actually been working with Virginia Tech and developed a relationship with them. We plan to work with them on part qualification as well. We've also worked with, you know, earlier I mentioned how do we print metal parts shipboard. Well, one of the groups we've begun to work with is NASA Langley Research Center, because they have a metal printer. Uses something called electronic beam freeform fabrication, and it basically uses, my understanding, I think it uses a solid spool kind of like the FDM printer, but it's a solid spool, and it welds it directly to the build plate, so you're not working with a powder. That's meant for a zero G environment for spaceflight. So we are working with them. Maybe technology like that could be useful to us in the future. We're also working with the Navy Supply System, NAVSUP, to develop a data repository to hold model files and also eventually allow users to request parts through that data repository. Instead of right now, we're just doing everything through email. But I see that's eventually where it's headed. So we have a wide range of experts. Actually, Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. I've met some of the top experts there. Very knowledgeable group of people. I just visited their facility. They spent a few days and trained me on a lot of their technologies and showed me what they were working on there. So again, we have a wide range of organizations working with both in industry and the Navy community and through academia. So again, right now we're really looking for, this is a call to see what's out there. From a research side of view, I have a lot of ideas of what we're doing and how to qualify parts, how to move forward. But in terms of trying to find examples of maybe difficult objects to print and supply to supply in a shipboard environment, that's what we're looking for now.
Perfect. And sort of as our final piece here in the interview draws to a close, one of the questions that the SimSec Peanut Gallery asked was about education. So let's say one day, fingers crossed, 3D printing becomes the fleet standard. It goes out to the fleet, just the same as laser engravers now are out there. Is anyone on your side of the bench thinking about how to educate sailors, who to qualify, how to qualify them in the use of additive manufacturing devices?
That's a great question. Yes. Oh, yeah, of course. Of course, we're looking at that. So what we want to do is we want to initially we've kind of developed a very short, let's say some very short training material for some of the more higher level individuals in the naval community to educate them on what the technology can do, because we want everybody to understand what it can and can't do to some extent, so that way we're not getting a bunch of requests for a bunch of parts that we have no way of printing. So we are developing that. We do plan to develop a more detailed Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. We're the ones who are actually working on Essex and put the printer over there. And so they develop training material for them. So they're actually working with them, and they've trained the sailors over there. So we're going to work with them to develop training material for we'll probably have a test bed over on the East Coast as well. So yes, we are going to train sailors, train everybody. We want to give as many people as possible a very broad overview of what the technology can and can't do today, maybe what it can do in the future. We also but I do want to say this, that I've noticed that as the technology becomes more common, you're going to have a lot of the younger sailors who are probably going to already know how to use the technology. I know when I was, I graduated Virginia Tech in 2010 and never used a 3D printer in my life. I sent a request in for something 3D printed in maybe 07. It got sent to someone in a shop and it got back to me several months later. Now I visited Virginia Tech and they have facilities. They have almost a MakerBot vending machine where users can just put in their flash drive and just print parts like a vending machine for free. So I think this is going to become more and more common. So there won't be as much training. I guess there's going to be a lot less training for the younger guys, the people who've kind of grew up with the technology.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Beyond that, we have the there is an additive manufacturing certification that kind of it's an intensive test that kind of goes over. It's run by SME and America Makes, and SME was formerly called the Society of Manufacturing Engineers, and the Milwaukee School of Engineering. And what that does is it's an intensive test that qualifies you in terms of your knowledge on all the major processes available. And so that's something that maybe the large players, I do plan on going out shortly to get that certification. Maybe the large players can get that certification, so that way they know in depth what the technology can and can't do.
Perfect. Well, Jim, it has been an education, and really, thanks. That was some fantastic stuff. I did not know half of that. Okay, I didn't know 8/9 of that. So I am. I definitely owe you. So I hope everyone else enjoyed this as much as I did. Jim, is there anything that you'd like to plug? You've already put out the announcement, so anyone who's on a ship listening to this, Jim, is there somewhere they should contact you if they've got parts they want to make with the 3D printer?
Yeah, they can contact me at James, J-A-M-E-S, .M.Lambeth, L-A-M-B-E-T-H, @gmail.com.
Boom. Easy. Using Gmail, which means probably something will get done as opposed to NFCI. and is there anything else that you'd like to plug out there so our listenership knows about it?
I do want to mention that this project that I'm working is called Print the Fleet, and it's a CRIC project. I'm not sure if I mentioned that, but which is a CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, so it's a high priority for the CNO. And I've had a lot of opportunity to work with the CRICsters, what they're called. They work for the Navy Warfare Development Command, and they're a very bright group of individuals working on a lot of different technologies in the near future. And so if anybody has the opportunity to work with some of those guys, I would strongly encourage it.
Fantastic. Well, Jim, thank you so much, and I'm going to let you get back to the normal business of the day.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Great content from the Center for International Maritime Security. Like the Sea Control podcast? It's at your fingertips. Go to www.cimsec.org. Don't forget to sign up at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and announcements by email. And hey, if you feel inspired, feel free to write us an article or two, or five. Make sure to check out our partners, our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, produced the Sea Control Asia Pacific Edition. Our friends at the Phoenix Think Tank produced Sea Control East Atlantic. This and other fine forums can be found on our homepage. Join the discussion.
So, we had an excellent interview with James Zanino, materials engineer and printed electronics, energetic materials, and sensors co-chair at the Picatinny Arsenal in New Jersey. However, as for some of those Luddites out there who do constantly cheer on the failure of technology, the computer has eaten that audio. But it was a fantastic interview, and I really appreciated the time that Jim took out. Now, there are some things that I wanted to bring up that he mentioned during the podcast, because I think at least they are worth discussion. Now, I won't go into a lot of what we spoke about because of the finesse and particular subtle points. I don't want to say something that he didn't, or maybe make a claim. You know, this is, again, the best part about an interview is the fact that you have the person's words right there. And I don't, obviously, have the words anymore. But what is happening at Picatinny is rather remarkable. So we think of 3D printing as what Jim Lambeth described. First interview with Damnick was talking about a 3D physical object. So something that you can pick up, you can throw around, it has weight. What Picatinny is doing, along with the more frequently discussed versions of 3D printing, is trying to print electronics and sensors. And this involves almost a painting process. So creating a chemical composition you can lay out on a material. It sounds slightly more, hey, you know, it's painting, you're not creating a 3D object. Well, in many ways, this is far more complicated and far more useful. He discussed the possibility of using this technology to build sensors into pallets. So if you're going to store ordnance or sensitive equipment, the pallet itself would have simply painted on, nothing complicated, a series of sensors that could detect anything from humidity to heat. Even for human beings, the possibility exists that such sensors could be created that would allow you to detect chemicals, specifically chemical weapons, or even for industrial safety. And this also, because of this electronic printing and the way that it operates, allows you to print smaller, lighter, and more efficient radios onto helmets or simplified circuits. There's so much possibility, and we're going to bring them back, but I wanted you to know that this technology was out there, and this is what folks were talking about. He also brought up the potential for ordnance to be 3D printed in the future. Now, what he did bring up, and again, this is great detail that I hope to bring back, is he discussed some quick printing of different kinds of fuses and circuits for purposes of making prototypes, which sounds incredibly exciting, but not something that you could use on a day-to-day basis. But what he discussed was he imagines one day, we talked about these pallets that require these sensors, and you'll have, and some folks out there in the fleet have seen it, cans of 50 caliber ammunition that has literally been around for the past 40 years. It's still good, but do you really want something like that sitting around? Well, you need to if you want to have that stock and backup supply. If you can 3D print that kind of stuff, maybe you don't have to worry about it. And the final topic that I want to hit on that we discussed was cybersecurity. Now, he did mention that cybersecurity is something that they're thinking about, and that it is, so it is on the radar scope. So a lot of folks, they think it's a brand new technology, and that just because it's new and just because it's shiny, people aren't thinking about these important security concerns or what could go wrong in the future. Well, they are, and it is something that concerns them. I brought up the Stuxnet. Hey, you know, if you can mess up a centrifuge in Iran, what happens if someone can mess up one of your 3D printers? And along with encrypted communications and secure systems, as we do with the rest of our equipment. Well, one of the things that he also mentioned that's incredibly important is trained operators. So not only will they have these secured communications like we do in many systems in the United States military, but you also have skilled operators watching these things happen. At the end, we also had a fantastic conversation about education. So there are out there U.S. Army soldiers that are certified in the use of this 3D printing equipment. Picatinny Arsenal is also engaging with colleges, and they are working on programs with NASA for future interplanetary missions for different kinds of vehicles and modules and manufacturing. But what I thought was most important was that they're also developing outreach to high schools and other pre-collegiate educational institutions. That's really important, because these are the guys that are going to be using this technology, and in many cases, and this is me talking, I imagine some of these guys know how to use it a little better. So I think that's a really smart move. And hey, if you can get these guys certified and engage earlier, and then they end up joining, boom, you've already got it yourselves an enthusiastic and certified operator for a lot of this equipment. Great content. We'll get them back. I just wanted to be able to pass those pieces of material onto you. For those looking for something to read during the week, of course, there is the regular blog, but we also had last week our Private Military Contractors themed week. I thought it was excellent. Lots of really good insights. And I still owe Emil, our associate editor for the event, my review of the book Civilian Warriors, which I do recommend. You haven't read my review, but hey, that's going to be pretty much the bottom line up front is, hey, it's a good book, go read it. I also recommend a piece, and not for good reasons, to read during the week is William S. Lynn's piece on An Officer Corps That Can't Score. You and I know, sitting here and listening to these many podcasts and enjoying these interviews that we have with different people, that there is a strong debate in the United States military amongst the officers and enlisted about where we're going in the future and just remaining educated. Some people don't necessarily believe that. And William S. Lynn's piece is a particularly stringent version of that point of view. And it's important to understand that point of view, even if it's wrong. I would recommend two responses. Now, Lieutenant Commander B.J. Armstrong will have his response to that article today at War on the Rocks. I don't know what it's called yet. It's probably there now as I post this podcast. But I recommend going there and reading that article. And if you have a moment, of course, reading my response, Our Debating Military, here, if you're looking, on SimSec. And really, that's all we got for today's podcast. I hope everyone had a fantastic Easter weekend, or Passover, depending. And for everyone else, I hope you had a great normal weekend. We are Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Please go onto iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio or wherever you get us and give us a 5-star rating and a comment. And of course, go to www.cimsec.org and follow us at SimSec, CIMSEC. And hey, feel free to follow me as well at America Hipple on Twitter. And